Okay, today is February 18th, President's Day holiday when they observe it. February 18th, 2013, this is the second interview with Ted Tibbetts. We're here at his home on the west side of Madison. And my name is Troy Reeves. I'm the oral historian for the UW-Madison Archives. So Ted, thanks for agreeing to meet with me.
It's my pleasure.
For sound quality, again, like we do with every interview, will you say your name and spell your last name?
My name is Ted Tibbetts, T-I-B-B-I-T-T-S.
Great, thanks. And Ted, as I told you before we had the recorder turned on, I think we want to start and maybe even spend most of our time today talking about your work with NASA. And if I remember right from our pre-interview, you said that started when you took a leave of absence to work at or work with North American Aviation.
Yes.
That in mind, if you just want to give
and,
us...
But little backup. The sure. reason I was so interested in getting involved with NASA was that I had a responsibility for head lettuce research here on the campus and in the state of Wisconsin. And there were some problems with head lettuce that obviously were involved with controlled environment and the temperature and humidity interactions on the growth of this plant. NASA at that time was headed for the moon and was also talking of growing lettuce on the moon. And I realized that they needed a lot of controlled environment research with lettuce if they were going to grow lettuce. So I saw NASA as a source of funding for this controlled environment research with lettuce that I was not able to get from the industry here in the state because the industry wasn't big enough.
Okay, so so how did that lead to the leave of absence and the work with North American Aviation?
Then I had the opportunity for a leave of absence from the university for 6 months. And so I looked at different NASA places where they might be growing lettuce, and one of these was down in Texas. But they did not have the facilities to do the kind of research with humidity and carbon dioxide that I wanted to work with. I had a contact with a fellow in Colorado that invited me to join him, but he was not directly associated with NASA, but I did find a series of studies that was going on at North American Aviation, and they were involved in putting a plant experiment on a biosatellite flight into space. And he invited me to join him, and I saw this then, even though it wasn't directly with NASA, it would provide the mechanism for me to make the contacts in NASA and know who I might contact for funding research.
Okay, so at first you knew of the work that NASA was trying to do, but you didn't quite know how to get in touch with them, and that's...
Well, I did have where the work was being done in Texas, okay. But they did not have the facilities to do the kind of research that I wanted to spend some time on during my research leave and feel that I was making some progress.
So what kind of work did you do during that leave of absence at North American Aviation?
The major part of it was associated with growing some small pepper plants and watching a reaction of leaves bending downward when they were rotated on a device called a clinostat, which kept them in a horizontal position and rotated them around about once every 10 minutes. And then the leaves bent backwards. And thus the space experiment was pointed toward directing to find out if under weightlessness these pepper leaves would also bend downward. And so a flight was eventually, after my leave period, a flight was made called a biosatellite flight in which the pepper plants flew into space and did truly bend downward. And so this reaction, they realized, was a reaction of weightlessness.
Okay. So when you were with North American Aviation, were you in California working?
Yes,
in California?
I was in Los Angeles at North American Aviation.
Okay, and was that you were working there, from your memory, were you working there every day? Was it a 9-to-5 job?
Oh, yes. It was a 9-to-5 job.
Okay.
Going through Los Angeles traffic. No, I was obligated to spend 5 days a week working with them. And then did help them with some other experiments and gave them a lot of advice on how to control the environment and measure it. Plus, I had some experience with air pollution in Los Angeles, and we had some problems on the plants in the experiment from the air pollution, which they did not recognize, but in time I was able to demonstrate to them that it was air pollution damage. And this opened up my eyes to air pollution damage, so that when I came back to Madison, I initiated a course in air pollution effects on plants, which had a lot of interest to all plant scientists, not just horticulturalists.
Was that a class that you taught to other faculty? Was that a class you taught to students?
No, it was to students, okay. undergraduate or graduate students. It was a 300 course.
Okay. And so was it the work through North American Aviation that got you the contacts you needed in NASA to be able to start to work with them?
Yes, it certainly was. And when I came back then, I did make contact and was able to, although they soon after I got back, within about a year, they made these flights. The moonshots were made, and then they decided not to develop a life support system up on the moon, and thus the need for lettuce research for NASA dropped off, and the use of plants for controlled environment life support in space dropped off. But I kept in touch with NASA over the years and did get some moderate funding from them each year for continuously, most of it directed towards studying leaf movements, and there were some other leaf movements, such as one big up and down movement per day, which is called a circadian movement, and some short-term movements that leaves make just automatically, and I think primarily to give them the best orientation to get light the best. These are only like about an hour in length. And I studied these movements for NASA and then also found out factors, whether magnetic fields or atmospheric pressure were affecting these, in Biotron studies over the next 10 years.
Okay. So just to go back to it briefly, so you work with North American Aviation, then did that lead to what you have here as co-investigator for capsicum experiments at the Biosatellite 1 and Biosatellite 2?
Well, yes, the North American opportunity definitely did this. And the person that had the experiments, Dr. Samuel Johnson, invited me to become a co-investigator on the experiment. So I made trips to Florida to watch this flight and to help load the package for the biosatellite flights. There actually were two of them. The first one was lost in space as it was coming down, and then a year later they flew a second experiment that was successful. And the plants were actually as a biosatellite capsule floated downward, an airplane caught it in flight over the Pacific Ocean and then took the package back to Hawaii. And Dr. Johnson was there to open it up and watch it, to put electricity back on it and watch it for another day and watch the leaves recover in Hawaii. But it was quite an amazing thing that they caught that biosatellite by an airplane.
Mm-hmm. But you did get to see the rocket take off, the satellite yes, attached to?
I was down at Kennedy watching him go off with a Delta rocket.
Was that the first time you'd ever seen something like
oh,
that?
Oh, yes, very definitely. It was quite exciting. And we were very close to those, much closer to the launch than they allow them to get today.
About how close do you remember being?
Oh, it was no more than an eighth of a mile. Wow. You were right there.
Yeah.
You certainly heard it and saw it.
Did you get to see them both then? Both go up?
Yes, I think I saw both of them.
Okay. It says that you organized a Plants in Space symposium at the American Institute of Biological Science in College Station in August of 67. I'm assuming that was an after effect of...
Yes.
This previous work.
Yes, I did a lot of organizing of programs and giving talks at, in this case, it was a biological science meeting, but also the American Society of Horticultural Science, which I was active in, and became very much involved with NASA in making advice and suggestions for how to use plants in space. The big one being then in 1979 and 80, NASA in 78, 79 decided they truly did want to look seriously at growing plants and a space base in Moon or Mars sometime in the future. And so they started putting significant amount of money into this program, and I was there waiting to help them. And the first thing I did was to organize two workshops, one in Chicago and one at Mountain View, California, at near Ames Station, Ames NASA Station in California. And these workshops were developed to recommend what plants might be used for life support. Not only just lettuce, but and the research that would be needed to develop this. And I invited 27 plant physiologists to each of those workshops. And we came up with five plants that should be looked at. Lettuce, white potatoes, sweet potatoes, wheat, and rice as potentials for life support in space. And recommending not using just one, but more than one, so that a more balanced diet could be obtained from this. And to particularly to find out how much space was required to use plants to effectively keep a person alive. This was in early 1980, and this led then to NASA making available a large amount of money for controlled environment research with plants, which initially I had a grant for lettuce, but rather quickly realized that lettuce didn't really provide that much protein and life support, and so I switched my research over to working with potatoes. For NASA, but at the same time studied problems with lettuce that were associated with the problems that our industry and the state had.
So it sounds like you had done work early on. So by early on, I mean 66 through maybe 70 with NASA, but it was really... in the late 70s and early 80s that it either came back or really...
That it really came back to what I had an interest of doing for the industry of the state, the horticulture industry in Wisconsin.
Had you done any research on potatoes up until you made this change, sort of seeing how the...
No. This was a major shift to get into potato research. Mm-hmm. And we did some very interesting things with potatoes that had some very significant implications for the potato industry. because we grew them under some very odd conditions, such as continuous light, to see how much, whether we could increase production. We studied very different temperatures and high humidities to see whether this would encourage tuberization. And came up with the fact that certain varieties can tolerate continuous light very nicely, but some other varieties just didn't grow at all under continuous light. It was quite amazing. However, if we gave them an alternation of temperatures each day, 24 degrees, and then dropped it to 16 at night, they grew perfectly all right. All varieties grew perfectly all right if they had an alternation of temperatures. And this is some things that people working on potatoes never had found, because there's little reason to work under continuous light. But it may have implications for potatoes being grown under very long days in some localities.
The change in temperature from 24 to 16, was that Fahrenheit?
Yes. So that, no, that's centigrade. Okay. So that we were going from about 75 down to 65 okay. during an eight hour dark period.
Now, when you started working in potatoes, I assume that work was being done, when it was here, was being done in the Biotron? Is that...
Much of this work was done in the Biotron. Okay. Almost, yes, all of the potato research, because they were too big for most of my chambers. Almost all of the NASA-related research, even the earlier research with leaf movements, was done in the Biotron, where we could have more careful control of conditions, because in our chambers that we had in the greenhouse annex, we could not be sure the carbon dioxide concentrations would hold steady because of people in and out of the area. And then some days there's a lot of people and other days very few people, and that would affect carbon dioxide levels inside our chambers and vary the growth of the plants.
I want to get to the Biotron, but I want to ask at least one more thing about NASA, and that is, so when you were working with NASA, were you working with specific people in NASA? I mean, how was the relationship day to day? Who were your contacts there?
Most of the contacts were in the NASA office in Washington. Certainly for most of these grants. And many of the panels that I served on to give advice to them were panels developed from the Washington office. On the other hand, I did travel frequently to the Kennedy Space Center, where NASA had put up their a plant growth facility to do studies within NASA on many of the same kinds of things that they were funding us to do at universities.
So those travels were to specific places where NASA was... So what type... I didn't quite get that, I guess.
Most of the time, the panels might be meeting in Washington, or they might be, some of them met out in California at the Ames okay. Research Center. Okay. We also went to Houston to the Spacecraft Center there. In the 80s and 90s, they developed NASA put up a closed life support system built at Johnson Spacecraft Center, built mm-hmm. a center. Never quite got it operational before the money was pulled from keeping the project going.
Mm. So did you did a lot of work here in the late 70s, early 80s. Did the funding change when the Reagan administration?
Not that I knew of particularly, okay. No.
So it didn't affect your...
No, it didn't affect me very much, because okay. partly as we got into into the 80s, we were funded under I became funded under another NASA project that was tied with the engineering school called the University Center for Automation and Robotics. And Dean Bollinger had invited me to join in their project on robotics to with the concept of helping develop automated plant growth facilities. This provided a large amount of funding, but and still provided me to use it for Biotron studies.
Okay. So when we were talking earlier, before the recorder was on, you said that the Biotron, you had a date when the Biotron was open, and if we don't remember it, that's not as important. I guess my initial question about the Biotron is, when did you find out about what was attempting to be done on campus to help with experiments like yours?
I was very interested in this Biotron as soon as they talked of it in the 60s. It became completed in late 1967, and as soon as it was open, I was there waiting for it when I had support money to rent space. And so I was the first paid plant researcher that paid for his space in the Biotron. There were some preliminary experiments done by the staff to make sure the rooms operated prior to that.
And was that one of your experiments in lettuce, or was it something else?
No, it would have been lettuce.
Okay. So what are your initial thoughts or memories about, maybe not specifically that first experiment, but sort of doing that experiment in a facility like that as opposed to the smaller controlled environments that you had within the greenhouse?
Oh, I was excited about having this facility on the campus, and it certainly supported the kind of research I wanted tremendously. I really liked it, and it was a great support because it was always available. There rarely were times when you were delayed getting in there. Usually, as long as you let them know a few months ahead of time that you wanted some space, you were always able to get it.
Can you explain to me and future generations so when you rented space and you had this space, how did you then use this space?
Okay, let me tell you a little about the space. It involved, I think it was 60 controlled environment rooms in this facility. Most of these rooms were 10 feet by 10 feet in size. And so you generally rented the entire room. They had couple rooms with smaller chambers in that could be rented at a reduced rate. And I did use some of that, but most of the time I was in a room all by myself doing what I wanted to do in that room. They also had a lot of unique rooms, such as a room that they could pressurize. They had a wind tunnel room that you could put plants in at different wind speeds. They had soundproof rooms for animals. They also had pressure rooms that you could up the pressure on the plants, but this was more significant for animals. But it was a fantastic facility, very unique. There was another facility that was constructed in North Carolina that was somewhat similar to this, but not at the scale. There was no other facility with as many large control environment rooms as the Biotron had. Nothing else in this country. Or world, for that matter, as far as I know.
When you were doing your experiments in there, I mean, obviously part of it, at least from what I understand, part of it is the fact that it is such a great facility that you don't have to worry about other people or other things affecting your research. But did you know what other things might have been going on
Arroyos, and that was part of the kinds of things that I got interested in, such as any contamination that might be in the Biotron rooms. And we did find that one of the materials, the ethylene glycol used for cooling, at times there would be little leaks around, and they would clean these up. But later on, we noticed that one room wouldn't, well, actually another experimenter pointed up his cucumbers would grow in one room and not in another room. And this led me to study the problem, and I found that it was the ethylene glycol that had been absorbed in the walls of the rooms as they distributed the air around, or in the floor itself. We didn't know for sure where it was coming from, but that it was the ethylene glycol that caused the problem.
Do you recall, did you take it upon yourself to do that research, or did the folks who ran the Biotron sort of ask
I did the research. They supported it.
Okay.
And would give me chambers or rooms at no cost when I was working with it.
Okay. Did you have graduate students helping you with these experiments, or when you did an experiment, was it just you?
No. Most of the time, it was a graduate student doing it.
Okay.
Or my research associate. Over the after the last 20 years of my career, I always had a research associate plus two or three graduate students.
And was this because of the outside funding that you would get?
Absolutely, and that was one of the biggest reasons for going after outside funding was to support graduate students or a research associate, because the university did not have the money for this.
Mm-hmm.
I got during my first 10 years, I think, about that period, I did get support from the university for a research assistant. But after that, all of the support help that I had was I paid for myself with the research grants that I obtained.
I'm just writing some stuff down here for a second. And I know we both have, you were kind enough to send me a bunch of preparatory material, and one of them is the grant research support summary. While you're looking for that, I have one. So the one thing, I guess another thing I want to ask about that is how did the graduate students or the RAs find you? I know you weren't doing a lot of teaching, you were mainly research, so how did the or how did you find them? How did they find you?
in the case of research assistants, it was a matter of searching them out most of the time. Sometimes some applied. The research assistants would apply to the department sometimes, and then they'd get referred to you. If it looked to the department chairman that this person fit a particular individual, and or if the department chairman knew I had research funds available for a research assistant. But very often at national meetings, I was constantly searching and advertising for research assistants. It was a hard thing finding good research assistants. Especially U.S. assistants. There were more foreign students that would apply, some with reasonable marks and credibility, but sometimes they would not have very good credibility, and it was hard to judge students. But early in my career, there were quite a few students applying from India. And so two of my early students were Indian students who did very well.
So you're talking about non-U.S. students. Was the issue, if there were an issue, was the issue language? Was the issue just not knowing what came, how their education at their home country?
Correct. Okay. Correct. Not sure that they could handle it. And you'd prefer, we preferred to have a U.S. student that you had more feel and you could judge by their courses that they presented to mm-hmm. their transcript as to what their capabilities were.
And how would you describe your relationship with these students? And by that I mean, was there any mentoring possibly going on as they were working for you, or was it more of a?
Oh no! You, as a graduate student, you led them through their master's degree and PhD degree, and so there's a tremendous amount of mentoring and discussion. Do you want to take this? Do you want to take that? And definitely prescribed courses that they would have to take to get their degree.
Now, was their master's and doctoral work, would it be based on the research that they were doing for you? Would it be their own research? Is it a little bit of both?
The courses they'd take were more prescribed for their major. And in horticulture, you could get a master's in horticulture, but for a PhD, it had to be a split major with some other department, agronomy or botany or biochemistry, commonly botany. And then there were just prescribed courses that had to be taken. There were very few elective mm-hmm. choices that students would take. A few, but not only two or three.
Okay. And then?
And then very often those courses would be something that was closely allied to the research that they were doing.
Okay. But the research they were doing, was it part of your larger research?
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
They were working on my research project.
Okay.
I don't know I had a single student that came with his own research,
okay.
No.
So the benefit for you, obviously, was skilled labor.
Very, very definitely.
And the benefit for them was the degree they were going to get.
Yes, yes.
Based on writing about the research
right.
in the larger project.
And thus, as they wrote about it, they were writing a thesis, but they were also at the same time writing papers that we would submit to journals for publication. Mm. And so for each student, there would be at least one paper, sometimes two.
Mm-mm.
Very often the paper was not finished until after the thesis was submitted, and sometimes the student had taken another job and left.
Hmm.
But you'd interact with him and work to get that published. And that was very significant. That was a significant part to me. I had to get publications from this research.
So that was another symbiotic part of it, is that you would both get... You'd both get publication, or you would co-publish. Were you co-publishing?
Yes.
Okay.
If the student basically wrote the paper, his name went on first and mine went on second. If he left and didn't write it up and I had to take the responsibility of going through his thesis and working up a paper, then my name usually went on first and his went on second.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were here, I would say one of the exceptions that you, I mean, you did all of your work here at UW-Madison.
Yes.
Any of the students that you worked with, did they come back here to eventually teach, or did they move on to other places and do other things? And I shouldn't say just teach, but also research, obviously. So do you recall any of the students coming back here to?
No, I can't think of any that actually did.
Okay.
No. And I discouraged it.
That's what I was, the follow-up
because
I was going to ask.
Yes, because professionally it was a real disadvantage of not having close contacts in another institution. And these people professionally often help you. If they're involved in some committee, they'll invite you to join their national committee and so on, or promote you for some job in nationally at their institution, and or if they're at another institution and they're looking for somebody for chairman,
mm-hmm.
they might invite you to join more often. So you miss those professional contacts for a few years. After I've worked for 10 years, I don't think it made much difference. Mm. I'd made the contact. Right. I went out and made the contacts in other ways.
Right. Was there a difference between your Biotron work with lettuce and your Biotron work with potatoes?
Not particularly.
Okay.
No. He did all solving different kind of problems.
Mm-hmm.
I was working on trying to prevent this tip burn in lettuce. And so I was working with high humidity at night with the lettuce. But more of the lettuce research was conducted in the smaller chambers. And almost all of the potato research was in the Biotron.
In terms of the actual, what you look at in the store, I guess, you buy a bag of potatoes, a lettuce, you buy a head of lettuce, so there's more potato than lettuce. But is that the reason why the potato research had to happen in one of the bigger rooms?
No, it was just more the nature of the research. We were working with a number of potatoes, usually it involved a number of potato plants for an experiment, and you'd want six or eight, or we might be doing two things within a chamber, shading some and not shading some. And the potato plant is pretty big. Whereas with the lettuce plant, we often worked with the lettuce plant before it headed, or just a small, we worked often with a butterhead variety, which is just no more than 4 to 6 inches across.
Mm-hmm.
And we're often working with individual plants, doing one thing with one plant, another with another. Or three plants would do one treatment to, and three plants another treatment to, in the same small chamber.
Okay. So I guess either thinking of lettuce, you're working lettuce or you're working potatoes, particularly when you were doing them in the Biotron, what sort of things would you do or would you direct your students to do on a typical day? Not that every day is typical, but what sort of things would you have to do if you had experiments or multiple experiments going?
Certainly just the setup of the experiment often took 2 or 3 days of getting the pots arranged, getting pots clean, getting them arranged, getting them filled with soil, measuring the different pots to see that they're all, temperature in the pots to see that they're all the same within a room. So there was a lot of work in setting up an experiment. Once the experiment was going, the biggest thing was watching the environment and making certain, we were checking on the Biotrons. They had temperature and humidity recording. But we had our own devices in there, and we're often doing our own measurement at least once a day in the Biotron and particularly if it didn't match up with what the Biotron was telling they had, we kept our own measurements.
Mm-hmm.
And we did other measurements. We measured light intensity, and once a week you'd measure the light intensity to see if it had dropped off significantly, and if so, you made some correction for it.
Mm-hmm. And during this time, too, when you were working in the Biotron, you were teaching as well.
Oh, yes.
But how? Were you teaching just one class a semester?
Usually I had one course a semester. I had a 30% teaching appointment and 70% research. And it usually was only one course a semester. Sometimes one course and in another seminar course, where I was only with them 1 hour a week in a seminar course.
And did you have TAs or any sort of assistance to teach those
usually
classes?
Usually I had one of my, I often use my research assistants to help me.
Okay.
I never had a formal TA during the time I was there, but I had my research assistants. That was part of their work then, was helping me teach.
So they knew that was part of the package.
Yes.
That they were coming into.
Often they were also taking, very often they were taking the course the first time.
Mm-hmm.
But then I would also, even though they were taking it, I would have them help me set up for a course.
Did you see that as important for your students because you had gone through this initial almost a decade at UW without teaching?
Yes, Partly, yes, but I was involved in watching teaching as a graduate student and so on. So, but more important, yes, very definitely, because chances are they would be getting into a job that involves some teaching. And so any techniques I used of projection would be useful to them, whether they use them or not, but it would be a basis to start from when they went out, did their teaching.
And now that we've been talking about this for a few minutes, is there any noted experiments that you did in the Biotron that stand out, either because perhaps of their success or perhaps not?
Much of it, the experiments, you do them several times over. you don't just do them once. I suspect the fact of finding this ethylene glycol toxicity was rather unique. We did some studies with a light in a put a big high-pressure lamp on the end of a light tube with light coming out the sides, a tube that was about 6 inches in diameter, and projected this light down across the room and then grew plants up around this light so that we're lighting the plants from beneath. This has initiated quite a bit of interest worldwide in using small light-emitting diodes in plant canopies. And I think our work on that initiated those studies.
You talk about doing experiments multiple times. Is that just part of science, either because you need to confirm your findings or debunk your findings?
Yes. Because often you are required to repeat it at least 3 times and 4 times in order to do a statistical analysis of it and look at the variation. And within an experiment, you were looking for maybe an effect of 2 different cultivars of varieties of lettuce and how they responded, or potatoes, 2 different cultivars of potatoes. And you'd look to see whether the variation within an experiment was greater than the variation between experiments. And that's a statistical analysis that you constantly did with any experiment that you ran. Because this one is 30% greater. Well, the next time you ran it, was it 30% greater or was it 10% greater? And so on. And difference within how fast each treatment grew.
Mm-hmm. How was the physical act of analyzing data? I mean, I ask that because in 2013, you know, you could have a little tablet or a laptop and all your information can be right there and you can let the computer analyze it. You can analyze it, you can do both. But, you know, when you're doing these experiments in the 60s and 70s, how are you and your students analyzing the data?
Well, we always had a little calculator over the years I was there. And initially, we did all of our own statistical analysis. You made up a table and you multiplied them out and you summed it up and subtracted and added. And then, of course, the computers came along and you could input this and the computer would do the statistical analysis for you as long as you inputted your values, told them what treatments you had. I grew up in an age when computers first started, and I, when it first came, I went and took a class in Fortran, so I would learn how to write programs. Well, I took that class in Fortran and realized there was no way that a professor had the time to write programs. And first, it led me to realize I had to teach my students to do much of the work. But secondly, that you don't write programs, you use a program as it's written. Mm-hmm. And it was back before we had, when I first started analyzing data, we did not have computers available to us.
When you were using computers here on campus, was it a central computing where you'd have to, you would bring, you or the students would bring the data to the computer?
We put the data on punch cards. Little cards that were about 4 inches deep by 7 inches wide, and had a lot of holes, and you'd punch your data in and take it to them, and then they would input those punch cards into the computer. You had devices, that's right, you had a little punch card printer. It's a long time ago.
Ted, there's something I feel compelled to ask when I know a person I'm interviewing was on campus during the late 60s and early 70s, and that's to ask them about their memories of or their thoughts about the student protest movement, particularly against the Vietnam War. Was that something either you were involved in or your students were involved in?
Some of my students were, but generally, the ag students were not very actively involved. I never canceled a class because of it, that I remember. It was sort of over on Letters and over on the hill. Certainly was not something I supported, and was quite disappointed. Mm-hmm. I had a mother that was in the hospital beside Sterling Hall and heard the blast that killed the person in mm-hmm. Sterling Hall, but I did not, was not involved.
Okay, so let me just make sure I get this right. You said you were not supportive of the students protesting the war, or were you not supportive of the war?
I was not supportive of the students protesting the war. I didn't feel that was a appropriate reaction.
Okay. And what about the war in general? Were you a supporter of the U.S. involvement in the war?
I didn't have a side one way or the other.
Okay. And then you said your mother was...
It happened to be in the hospital just at that time.
So she heard it.
Yes.
Because, I mean...
It was
today,
at night.
Yeah, today the hospital complex is over on the west side of campus, but in 1970 the hospital was right across the street from, at least one side of the hospital was right across the street from Sterling Hall.
Yes.
Okay. All right. I wanted to make sure I made sure that your words were what you wanted to say about that. Is there anything else you want to say today? Well, actually, you know what I want to finish with today is we've sort of talked around it, but I want to talk specifically about your teaching during this time period, because we ended with it at the end of the last session. You know, the idea that you had decided that you needed to teach because it was important to your improvement as a faculty member.
And keep up on plant science, new findings in plant science. I found there wasn't.
So it looks like your first course was the vegetable crop production course.
This was a course that has always been on the books in the horticulture department. And so for a period I took over that course. Prior to that time, the chairman of the department had been teaching it, and then I took it over from him for 5 years. But the next course, the environment of horticultural crops, was a course that I developed myself. And what I saw, in horticulture, we had a course on ornamentals, one on fruits, one on vegetable crops. And each one of these teachers, each of these courses, had sections on the environment of how temperature and light and humidity affected the plants. And I realized I had more knowledge on this subject than most of these other people did, And so I developed this course to give the details of the environment and accurately, and how to measure it, and to minimize the amount of duplication that there would be in these separate courses on each of the on vegetables and fruit and so forth. And so this was very popular and continued to be taught. And then about 1980, it was made a required course for the department, that all students had to, all horticulture students had to take it. And then when G. Wan Palta came into the department, he was interested in helping with the course. And so the two of us taught this course. And I taught the environment side of it, and he taught the plant response side of the course.
Okay. So it looks like it was your longest.
And it is still being, yes, and it's still being taught. Mm-hmm. When I retired in 1995, that was the last time I taught it.
Okay. So the official title of Horticulture 320 is Environment of Horticultural Crops. Does environment mean just physical environment, or was it, or did environment mean other things as well?
No, it was just the physical environment. Okay. Not the chemical environment. Okay. Not, it did not include nutrition, for instance. And then for a period, we taught a laboratory, which the students took the students out and actually buried temperature sensors in this, at different depths in the soil. And then they watched these at weekly intervals over the winter period, which was quite interesting to them, but the department did not feel it was a necessary course, and so we only taught this for 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm. And then it looks like another course that was developed in the late 60s, and I think you alluded to this earlier, is HORT 420 Air Pollution in Plants.
Yes. This, again, was a course that I developed that was initiated by my experience in Los Angeles, California, with the smog and pollution they had out there. That got me interested, and I dug into it and developed a course on it because there was a small amount and a potential for pollution everywhere. This was in sort of in contrast to the environment course, which was just for horticulture students. This was a popular student course by all plant science students in agriculture and in botany. And I taught this for 20 years up until 1989. And then when I went on a leave period, a person in plant pathology picked it up and has been teaching it since.
Okay. So would you, so it looks like for a long chunk of time, would you teach HORT 320 one semester and HORT 420?
The other semester, okay. Yes.
And did you
I didn't do the two in the same semester.
Okay. And did you do any teaching in the summer?
No. I never did any summer teaching.
Okay.
Except for graduate students that were with me all the time. And I was on a 12-month appointment constantly. So
your teaching was the teaching you did throughout the year in the summer, which was individual teaching of your graduate students,
yes,
as you were,
yes,
doing your research.
Yes.
Okay. Ted, we've jumped around here a little bit, but I think I'd like to wrap up here. I want to spend the next session taking us through the 80s and 90s to the end of your teaching. Anything else you want to say? So I want to make sure if there's anything on your mind that we get it on the record this time. So is there anything else you want to say today?
No, I think not.
Okay.
Covers it well.
All right. Well, this concludes the second interview with Ted Tibbetts. And Ted, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.